The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Contemporary Christian theory of knowledge. Gordon Clark, at least, is very fond of Augustine's approach at this particular point. Certainly, Augustine is far more scripture-centered. He brings in a lot of the biblical teachings about knowledge, and he is concerned with doing justice to those. Aquinas erects his Christian theology on a foundation of Aristotelian philosophy, and I think is less sensitive than Augustine is to the need for a distinctively Christian approach here. I won't say much more about Aquinas, except I think there's a real danger in Aquinas' system to try to erect a Christian view upon a non-Christian foundation. And I think that's at least what he does up to a point in his thinking. Not that there's nothing worthwhile in Aquinas, but I think there is that problem that runs all through his work. Then we come to the continental rationalists of the 17th century, Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. Descartes, now this is the rationalism in the narrow sense that I mentioned before. Up until this point, I've been talking about rationalism in a broad sense, rationalism in the sense of a claim to autonomy, a claim to exhaustive knowledge, a claim to be able to understand everything using your own mind as the final criterion. These men are rationalists in that sense, but they're also rationalists in a somewhat narrower sense. Rationalism in the narrow sense, I think, really begins with Parmenides. Parmenides says that human reason is the only organ we have for knowing all of reality. Plato follows Parmenides closely there, though not as consistently. Then we have these figures in the more recent period, Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. Descartes begins by trying to doubt everything that can possibly be doubted, known as the method of universal doubt. And he maintains that he will not... he's trying to build knowledge up from its foundations. He's trying to build up a body of knowledge anew, afresh. This is sort of the Renaissance spirit. Let's start something new. And, well, no, not so much. The Renaissance thinkers, of course, wanted to go back to ancient Greece. But Descartes wants to erase all tradition. He wants to say, what if we were here without any previous philosophy, without anyone who's thought about this before, without any religious traditions on the subject, what could we come up with? Essentially, Descartes then is trying to start entirely afresh. And the way he does that is by proceeding to doubt anything which in his mind can possibly be doubted. And is there any limit to this? Well, Descartes says he will stop doubting when he runs across an idea which he clearly and distinctly perceives to be true, a clear and distinct idea. Well, there's a subjective criterion, if ever there was one. But anyway, Descartes is looking for an idea which he clearly and distinctly perceives to be true, and he comes across one which I've described here by the Latin word cogito. Descartes says, I can doubt everything, almost, but I can't doubt the fact that I'm doubting. I can't doubt the fact that I am thinking. I can't doubt that there's something going on up here. So I can't doubt that I'm doubting. I can't doubt that I'm thinking. And then he comes up with his famous syllogism, I doubt, therefore I am, or I think, therefore I am. And therefore he's proven, at least to his own satisfaction, he's proven his own self-existence. And from his self-existence, he goes on to prove the existence of God, prove the existence of other people existing outside his own mind, and so on and so forth, and comes to prove most of the traditional beliefs of mankind through that method. We find here, of course, certainly a case of rationalism in both the broad sense and the narrow sense. Certainly he's a rationalist in the broad sense, because he's certainly seeking to come up with an exhaustive understanding of the world, and to do that on the basis of his own reason, or on the basis of criteria that are within his own mind. That's rationalism. He has a kind of mathematical ideal. He wants to reduce all human knowledge to mathematical formulas in some way. He doesn't get very far on that project, but he thinks that that's at least a possibility. He defines the mind as being so unique that he has a lot of trouble relating the mind to the body. And I could go into this in some detail. It's a little bit amusing, some of the tricks that he pulls in order to get the mind and body together after defining them as being so sharply distinct, so sharply apart from one another. Some recent philosopher, Gilbert Ryle, has described Descartes' view of mind and body as the view of the ghost and the machine. It's a little bit of a caricature of Descartes, but not entirely so. The body is a mere machine, whereas the mind is something totally different from the body, which just happens to be located there. And how can it be located there if it's that totally different? But anyway, you have what is called mind and body dualism in Descartes. I'll tell you a little bit about his view of mind and body. He maintains that the mind is totally unextended. It has no length, it has no height, it has no weight. And so therefore, theoretically, you would assume that the mind can't possibly move the body. The mind has no power, the mind has no strength to move an arm or to move a leg or to move any part of the body. At this point, Descartes is faced with a mystery. And faced with a mystery, you can do various things. You can resort to mysticism, as Plotinus did, or you can simply cheat. And that essentially is what Descartes does. Descartes found a gland in the body known as the pineal gland, which at the time nobody knew if there was any use for this gland or not. And Descartes said, and this is his little bit of mythology, just like Parmenides came up with some mythology, and just like Plato came up with some mythology, here's Descartes' little bit of mythology. He says, well, the pineal gland really is that place where mind and body meet. And right there, of course, the mind is unextended, the mind has no weight, the mind can't push the body at all, but in the pineal gland it can push it just a little bit, okay? Just a little bit, and that little bit pushes something else a little bit, and pretty soon you get arms moving and legs moving and the bodily motions taking place. Well, you see again how the rationalist finds himself in a corner and has to resort to irrationalism, has to resort to mythology in order to make his system work. Spinoza now wants to be more consistently rationalistic than Descartes is, both in the broad sense and in the narrow sense. He has one of these rationalistic slogans, like I mentioned with Parmenides and others. He says the order and connection of ideas is the same as the order and connection of things. All right? Perfect correlation somehow between my ideas and the way they are organized on the one hand, and the world and the way the world is organized. So every thought, you see, here are the thoughts, and here's the world, here's the course of history. And this thought corresponds to this event, this thought corresponds to this event, this thought corresponds to that event. Perfect parallel, perfectly parallel order between the two. He believes that philosophy can be reduced to the method of geometry. He imitates Euclid's geometry in writing his book, which is entitled Ethics. He starts with theorems, propositions, deducing one from the other. He starts off, of course, with self-evident axioms, axioms which seem to him to be self-evident. And then from those axioms, he deduces various propositions and theorems, just the way a geometry book would do, develops his philosophy in that kind of way. Well, you see that that's a very rationalistic kind of project. Like Parmenides, he eliminates whatever his reason can't account for, such as free will, moral responsibility, moral choice, that kind of thing. Like Parmenides, he comes to a pantheistic point of view. There's basically one object in the world, and that object can be called God or nature. So monism and pantheism come together there. Mind and matter, he faces that same problem that Descartes did. If mind is one thing and matter is something else, how do the two get related to one another? To Spinoza, rather than defining these as being opposite to one another, what Spinoza does is to define them as being the same thing from different perspectives. The mind is the thought of matter, and matter is the extension of the mind. So really, mind and matter are the same thing, but when you look at it from one perspective, it's matter. When you look at it from another perspective, it's mind. He says, with regard to the human life, he says, the mind is the idea of the body. The mind is the idea of the body. And so he's able to get these things together, bring about a more consistent monism than could be found in Descartes. Leibniz is a rationalist of an atomist sort. Remember, like the Greek atomists, he believes in getting to the ultimate truth, not by trying to combine everything together into one thing, the way Spinoza did, but by chopping everything up into its ultimate components. And remember, the atomists tried to do that, and they came up with little atoms as the basic constituents of the world. What Leibniz does is he cuts things up into their ultimate components, and when he gets to the end of the process, what he's got is mind, okay? He cut up this table into as many pieces as you can possibly cut it up, and what you've got left over is mind. Little mind-like entities, he called them, which he describes as monads. Tiny mind-like entities. So we find the rationalistic tradition kind of working over this question of mind and matter. Both Spinoza and Leibniz are trying to work it up, and Leibniz comes to the conclusion that everything is mind. Spinoza comes to the conclusion that mind and matter are just different ways of looking at the same thing. The rationalist, again, wants to see an identity between the mind and the object of knowledge. What we know is really ourselves. What we know is really mind. And therefore, the object gets reduced to the subject of knowledge. John Locke, now looking at the British empirical tradition, I mentioned before that empiricists are people who believe that knowledge comes through sense experience. Looking at the British empirical tradition, we have John Locke. Locke seeks to develop a pure empiricism, that is to reduce all knowledge to sensation. And this eliminates mysterious a priori concepts. He doesn't believe in Platonic forms, for example, and allows, supposedly, a more autonomous perspective. So although Locke is an empiricist, and so far as his tradition is concerned, he's very much a rationalist in the broad sense. That is, he's trying to find an autonomous perspective that will give ultimate knowledge. No innate ideas, as Plato taught. Rather, the mind begins as a blank slate. Each of us is born with a mind that's empty. And how do we get things in our minds? Well, simply by sensing them, as the data comes from our sense experiences. What about revelation? What about divine revelation as a source of knowledge? Well, says Locke, there might be such a thing as revelation, but revelation from a divine being is never as certain as the principles of reason. So you see, revelation has to be judged by our reason. Revelation has to be evaluated by our own autonomous reason, which is to say, again, Locke is a rationalist in the broad sense of that word. He's a rationalist in the sense that he believes in human rational autonomy. Of course, he's not a rationalist in the sense of somebody who elevates reason over sense experience. Well, empiricism historically has led to irrationalism, and you don't quite see that in Locke. You see that the tradition develops from one thinker to another thinker. You see that as history moves from Locke to Berkeley to Hume. And so I have that process down here on page 4. As you move from Locke to Berkeley, Berkeley teaches a radical form of empiricism. His slogan is esse est percipi, to be is to be perceived. Nothing exists except perceptions. Nothing exists except what someone perceives. There are, he says, no abstract ideas like Plato's abstract idea of a triangle or a man in general or tree in general. Nothing like that, according to Berkeley. We know only our own perceptions. Therefore, things exist only in the perceiving mind. See, again, Berkeley is very much a rationalist in the broad sense. He's saying that the very being of things exists in my mind. The very being of things exists in the mind. It's not something that exists outside the mind. And the reason he's saying that is, again, he wants to have a perfect correspondence between what's in the mind and what the mind knows, all right? And the only way he knows to do that is to bring everything in the mind so that the only thing that exists is thought. Thought is adequate because thought is the same as its object, essentially. We know only our own perceptions, therefore things exist only in the perceiving mind. We call that idealism. Idealism is the view that everything is mental, everything is mind. How does this happen? Because I don't control, he says, the order of my thoughts. Thoughts come upon me without my bringing them up. Something happens here, and here he says he's got a proof for the existence of God. Because these thoughts keep moving along inside our heads and we don't have perfect control over them, who does have perfect control over them must be some other mind outside ours, because there's nothing except minds in Berkeley's universe. Must be another mind somewhere, and that is the mind of God. So he proves the existence of God that way. You see here a certain degree of rationalism in that even the existence of things depends upon thought, but irrationalism, we know nothing outside ourselves, and the existence of God is an inference from our own autonomous experience. Then you come to David Hume, and Hume, I think, will show you how this whole tradition of empiricism leads to skepticism, or leads to irrationalism, leads to the end of knowledge. He says, first of all, he's skeptical of a lot of things that previous empiricists have maintained. Hume says that there is no material substance. That's what Berkeley said. Berkeley said there's nothing except mind, nothing that corresponds to mind. There's only mind. Hume says, you're right, there is no material substance, but now he turns on Berkeley and he says there's no mental substance either. He says if you only look at things through your eyes and through your ears, through your sense organs, if you see the world only through your sense organs, you can't identify anything that can be called substance. You can't identify physical substances, because all you know is your own perceptions. That was Berkeley's argument. But you can't know mental substance either, because you don't, you know, among all the things you see, you don't see a mind, right? I see the clock on the wall, I see a tree out there, I see people in the room, I see chairs. I don't see any minds. I don't even see my own mind. So the mind is something that sense perception can't detect. And therefore, if sense perception is your standard, then there is no such thing as mind. There's no physical substance, there's no mental substance either. B, there's no necessary connection between cause and effect. Hume said, look, you see one motion of a billiard ball, knocks the other billiard ball, and the second billiard ball moves. We say the first motion is the cause of the second motion. And people have traditionally said that there's a necessary connection between those two. That when the first ball moves, the second ball has to move. It's forced to move. There's a necessity imposed upon it. Hume says, no, I don't see any necessity. Just look at it with your, you know, again, be a serious empiricist. Restrict yourself to what your eyes will tell you. Restrict yourself to what your sense organs will tell you. You don't see any necessary connection between those things. You see one ball move and you see the other ball move, but you don't see any necessary connection between the two. You don't see any force transmitted. So all you see is one motion and then another motion. And that's all, Hume says, that's all causality is. It's just one thing that's regularly followed by something else. People have sometimes criticized Hume's view, the rooster crows every morning and then the sun comes up. Does that mean that the rooster causes the sun to come up? There's a kind of regular connection there. But anyway, Hume is putting the burden of proof on those who would show that there is some kind of necessary connection between the cause and the effect. So we have no metal substance, no material substance, no necessary connection between cause and effect. He's critical of the arguments for the existence of God, which Locke and Berkeley, of course, accepted to some extent. He says that it's impossible for us to believe in miracles because he says it's impossible to have sufficient testimony to prove that a miracle has taken place. So we can't believe in miracles. He argues in another place that there's no way that you can reason from is to ought, from circumstances to values, to moral values, which was the case many philosophers tried to argue that. When you add up all these things, you can't know metal substance, you can't know material substance. If you take that term substance seriously, what Hume may be saying is that you can't know anything. You can't know mind, can't know matter, can't know things, can't know the object, can't know the subject of knowledge, can't know causality, at least in any sense that people have been historically accustomed to talking about causality. You're reduced almost to knowing nothing. And Hume felt that. He said that these skeptical doubts really got him down sometimes, and he had a hard time living in this world, realizing that he knew so little. But then when he started feeling this way, he'd get up and play a game of backgammon, and then he'd go back and start philosophizing again, and he could go on for a little while longer. But you see, that's to admit that philosophy has really become impoverished, that the search for knowledge has really come apart at the seams, that we really know almost nothing, or we can't give any account of the knowledge that we have. Then we come to Immanuel Kant, page 5. Remember Plato. Plato tried to solve these problems of knowledge by dividing the world in two, between the world of forms and the world of matter. Kant also tries to face these problems by dividing the world in two. Kant, like Plato, is trying to combine a lot of previous insights. Kant was trained as a rationalist in his youth. He was trained by a disciple of Leibniz named Wolff. And then he began to read David Hume. And he said, when I read David Hume, I awoke from my dogmatic slumbers. When he read Hume, he saw that there were some serious problems connected with knowledge, and that if we were to save human knowledge, and when he said knowledge, he meant especially mathematical knowledge and the knowledge of the physical sciences, in order to save knowledge, we have to answer David Hume. We have to find some way to escape from the skepticism that he's placed us in. Well, how are we going to do that? He divides the world into one aspect which is knowable, and another aspect which is not knowable. He says that, this is the way Dr. Van Til used to diagram Kant's philosophy. The noumenal world is the real world, the world as it really is, the world apart from what anybody thinks it may be, the objective world, if you want. That's the world that we cannot know, he says. We cannot know the real world, the world as it really is, the world apart from our own thinking. However, we do know the phenomenal world. The phenomenal world is the world as it appears to us. It's the world, and the reason I put this grid here, it's the world that we have been organizing with our minds. It's the world that we have conceptualized, the world that we have come to understand. That's the world of appearances. And Kant calls that the phenomenal world, the world of appearances. Now, the phenomenal world is really what we can study. The phenomenal world is what we can gain a knowledge of. In fact, so far as the phenomenal world is concerned, Kant is very much a rationalist. See, what we've got here is Kant is an irrationalist so far as the noumenal world is concerned. He's a rationalist so far as the phenomenal world is concerned. And let's look at this phenomenal world. The phenomenal world is knowable. Why is it knowable? Because its structure is created by our minds. Okay? Gives it plurality and unity and causality and all those things. Kant says, the reason the world looks like that, the reason why the world has unity, plurality, causality, and so on, is because my mind imposes those things upon the world. Okay? my mind imposes those things upon the world. It's a little bit, I think this is Gordon Clark's illustration, it's a little bit like you have a row of very intelligent jelly jars on the shelf, and the jelly jars are philosophical, and they debate the subject of why jelly always takes the same shape when it's poured into a jar. And they're very scientific. They analyze the chemical composition of the jelly and so on and so forth, but they can't find anything about that jelly that requires it to always take that shape. And then one jelly jar, who is very, very intelligent, the most intelligent one on the shelf, says maybe it's not because of something in the jelly, but it's because of something in us, he says. Maybe it's not that the jelly has such and such properties, but because we have that shape. And that's why the jelly takes that particular shape. Well, that's basically what Kant is saying. Kant is saying the world looks the way it does because that's the shape that our minds have. Our minds put it into that shape. We get raw data from the world, and then the mind shapes it and puts it into various forms, like an assembly line. And it imposes upon the world various shapes, like spatial. It makes the world spatial, makes the world temporal, makes the world to be a causal order, makes the world to be a temporal order, makes the world to be unified, makes it plural, and so on and so forth. All of this happens because of the structure of our mind. That, I say, is rationalism, a very high degree of rationalism. Because, you see, the mind contributes the structure. You might say, if you compare Kant with Plato, you almost have to say that for Kant, Plato's forms are in the human mind. The human mind imposes Plato's forms upon the world. Triangularity, manhood, treehood, all those properties that make the world to be what it is, those come from us. And so really, we are the ones who play the role that was played by Plato's world of forms. We are the ones who play the role of God, if you will. We create the structure of the world. Indeed, if this structure is to explain everything, perhaps there's nothing that's real except the structure. And if that's the case, then we create everything. What is the world apart from the structure? The world apart from the structure is nothing. It's just raw stuff. It's not round. It's not square. It's not intelligent. It's not stupid. It's not long. It's not short. All of those things we contribute. So really, the raw data is nothing. And what we contribute is everything. And therefore, we are in the role of God. If you study Kant's philosophy carefully, you will find out that over and over again, he tries to solve philosophical problems by putting human thinking in the role of God, which is a virtual definition of rationalism. And he emphasizes rational autonomy in all areas of human knowledge, including religion. He wrote a book called Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone, in which the human mind is the judge of all supposed revelations, supposed religious truth. Now, number four, he says, we may speculate about the noumenal world, that is, the world as it really is. We can speculate about that. We don't have any knowledge of it, but we can speculate about it for practical reasons. For example, he says it's practical to believe in God. If you're going to live a moral life, it's better to believe in God than not to believe in God. It's better to believe in a God who punishes evil and rewards the good than it is to not believe in a God, because that motivates you to behave better. Now, it's not that you know, you bow before the revelation of a god. That's certainly not the case for Kant. He tells us over and over again not to do that. But we must, after we have autonomously decided what is right and wrong, what is good and bad, then, having made that decision, then we decide that it's more practical to believe in God than not to believe in God in order to implement our own autonomous morality. So we can deduce the existence of God in a way from our own autonomous thinking about morality. In Kant's later writings, this kind of reasoning becomes more and more prominent, this practical reason, reasoning to certain conclusions for practical reasons. And it almost becomes to the point where you wonder, you know, in his early writings, he says this noumenal is unknowable. But in his later writings, he keeps saying, we should believe this about the noumenal because of practical reasons, and we should believe that because of practical reasons, and so on and so forth. All these things because of practical reasons. The result seems to be that the practical reason is almost a second way to knowledge. It's almost a second avenue to knowledge, perhaps a perspective on knowledge. Now, Kant's philosophy has been tremendously influential on 20th century philosophers, 20th century theologians. It's a perfect example, too, of rationalism and irrationalism working together. On the one hand, Immanuel Kant is a blithering irrationalist because he says we know nothing of the real world. Okay. On the other hand, Immanuel Kant is a very arrogant rationalist because he's saying the world as we know it is virtually our own creation. All right. It's not only that we know it autonomously, it's our own creation. We are knowing ourselves when we come to know the real world. Then Hegel comes along and he eliminates the Kantian noumenal world. That's the main difference, I think, between Kant and Hegel. He eliminates the noumenal world. And having eliminated the noumenal world, of course, the noumenal world can't play a role in our philosophy. And if that's the case, then we're left with the phenomenal. But then the word phenomenal doesn't play any role because you're not using it to distinguish anything. Phenomenal is not distinguished from anything. So really, the phenomenal world becomes the real world, according to Hegel. So we're back in a more traditional philosophical approach in one way. In another way, Hegel introduces some very new and radical things. But for Hegel, there are not two worlds, there's just one. For Hegel, there's only one world, and that's the world we're living in, and that's the world we're trying to know. There's no distinction between phenomenal and noumenal. And indeed, we're trying to know that real world exhaustively. Same old rationalism that we've seen over and over again. We're trying to gain all our knowledge with an autonomous perspective. We're trying to gain all knowledge of the world. Still, Hegel, number two, is chastened by the critical work of Hume and Kant. He takes seriously the problematic character of knowledge. But he's optimistic that the problems can be overcome. And see, he's read Hume too. He sees that there's a lot of reason to be a skeptic, but he's confident that he can get beyond skepticism without taking Kant's route. So he says, here's the way it works. Here's the way he evades skepticism. Well, the very contemplation of the problems. See, mind-body problem. Take any problem in philosophy. The simple contemplation of the problems leads to a fuller understanding of the truth. Every idea, when you reflect on it, contains problems. okay? Almost anything, any idea you have, just think of your last term paper, whatever it may be. Any idea you have, when you think about it a little bit, carefully, you can see problems in that idea. And you can see some truth in the opposite idea. See, perspectivalism. You can see truth in opposites, okay? And then you look at that opposite idea and you think that through and you see there's something wrong with that too, and that leads you to an even better idea, okay? So it's that self-critical spirit that moves you along. It's that self-critical spirit that leads you to better and better ideas. And so every idea, when you reflect on it, leads you to embrace a negation, and then that leads you to a higher synthesis, and so on and so forth, until you reach the ultimate. You get to a point where you have all knowledge, okay? You get to a point where you have that exhaustive knowledge that all these people have been dreaming about. To Hegel, that's a real possibility. You may get there someday. When you reach the absolute, now here's this theme that we've been noticing in several contexts. When you reach the absolute, when you reach the ultimate, when you get to the point where you have all knowledge, then idea and reality merge, okay? Subject and object melt into one another so that there's not just a correspondence between the idea and the reality. There is an identity between the idea and a reality. The two of them come together. The two of them become one. And there you have the rationalistic side of Hegel. And he says that since the absolute is God, then, of course, there's a threefold correlation. There's your idea, and there's the reality to which it corresponds, and there's God. God is the idea. The idea is the reality. The reality is God. God is the reality. Get all those three together. God, the reality, the idea. Your idea is God, okay? The reality is God. The only reality is God. Bring it all together in one, just as in Parmenides, just as in Spinoza. So the consummation of this process. But notice in Hegel, it's kind of historical, you know. It's kind of moving along. It's not doesn't happen all at once. You start off with a kind of dumb idea, and you start to notice problems in that idea, and then you notice problems in that one, and you get more and more knowledge as you move on. And it's only at the end of history. See, it's a kind of historical movement. It's at the end of history that you reach this consummation in which everything is one. Yeah. Yes, if my idea is God, then I'm God. That's right. No creator-creature distinction in the final analysis. Now, however, if that's what happens when you get the ultimate truth, if that's what happens, if that's the criterion of truth, then how can we ever have truth today? Seems as though what Hegel really wants to say is that for us to have any truth at all, there has to be that kind of union between the idea, the reality, and God. There has to be that kind of threefold union, which would mean that in some sense, that union must exist even now, okay? It may be hidden, it may be in shadows, but somehow it exists even now. It exists even at this moment, and it's only later to be uncovered. So the historical process is really only apparent. Unfolding is really only a clarification of what is the case even today. I go into that because there's a theologian today whose system of theology is almost identical with this, and he turns this history into the history of redemption. Do you happen to know who that theologian is? Wolfhart Pannenberg, okay, whose who does almost the same thing with in using Christian language, putting that kind of Hegelian structure into Christian terminology. Yes.
Under number three.
Yeah.
You have handwritten there presuppositions and or.
Yeah, I want to get back to that in a moment. I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't have put it in right there. Anyway, when we six, however, Hegel has not sufficiently guarded himself against a possible negation and transcending of his own philosophy. He didn't think it was possible, but others thought it was. You see, you can read Hegel in a kind of skeptical way. You can say, well, whatever idea you have, you can find something wrong with it. And if you look at Hegel's own philosophy with any kind of, you know, any kind of sensible judgment, you would have to say that there's probably something wrong in Hegel too. Therefore, Hegel's philosophy is going to be overturned, and we'll find something better and a fuller idea, and so on and so forth. So that's if you take it that way, you see, you never know what the truth is, because anything that you think is the truth may be overturned, turned into its opposite, and go on to a further synthesis. So on that reading, then you never have any truth at all. Rationalism degenerates into total irrationalism. But, if you read it in Hegel's way, then when you get to the final consummation, then you are God, you are divine. So you have either that choice, you have that choice of two alternatives, either total skepticism or total rationalism. Both of them seem to be about equally capable of being derived from Hegel's philosophy. One interesting thing about Hegelianism and the idealist movement is that they seem to be the first philosophers to bring in the notion of a presupposition explicitly. That's what I meant by that little note there. They argue that the necessity of presupposing the absolute, you have to presuppose that the absolute either exists now or is going to exist in the fullness of history, however you want to read that. And therefore, having presupposed that, then you can develop a theory of knowledge that works and overcomes all the problems that have been found in history. Well, Kant did a little bit of that, but I think it becomes more explicit in Hegel and others, and so Hegel might be described as in some ways the founder of presuppositionalism. Dr. Van Til studied under Hegelian scholars at Princeton University in the 1920s, and a lot of his early writing you'll find is mixed up with Hegelian terminology from the idealist movement. The apologist named James Orr, I mentioned Orr in that little note too, Orr is kind of a predecessor of Van Til in one way, that is that he also used the notion of presuppositions, he used idealist philosophy for an evangelical purpose, that is in the interest of an evangelical apologetic. So that's another way in which the idealist has been speaking to me in preparing DKG, yes. Yeah, well, Van Til is deeply influenced by Bavinck, I think also directly by Orr. So as you read Van Til's critiques of previous apologists, he's usually pretty negative toward them, but you'll find that what he says about Orr is much milder than what he says about most of his apologetic predecessors. He doesn't like everything about Orr by any means, but when he does speak about Orr, he's somewhat less critical, less harshly critical of Orr than he is of some others. So, well, I'm sorry, I didn't judge very well how long this is going to take. I'm going to spill over until tomorrow quite a bit, but I do want to give you some general picture of the history of epistemology, especially as it underlies Van Til's work, especially as it underlies DKG. So I hope you'll be patient with me and give this some thought. I do want you to read still that portion that I've assigned for tomorrow so we don't get too far behind.